So we left off, I'm talking about issues related to parfud and sharp foods, the harif. So everything we've really been doing up till now has been related to issues related to dairy and meat and kosher from that perspective. At this point, we're really moving on to different topics in kosher, including certain aspects related to the kosher of meat, fish, and we'll talk a little bit about insects. And then the next volume, after we talk about insects, we'll talk about things related to the kosher kitchen, koshering items, appliances. So that's where we're headed. So we're beginning on page 187. And our topic today is the topic of glot meat that is, in Hebrew, it's called chalak. Chalak means smooth, and we'll talk about what that means. But I entitled this year, what does glot kosher actually mean? Because in common parlance, when we say something is glot kosher, or super glot kosher, we can come up with all these categories. So people will assume that glot kosher means, or sometimes assume that glot kosher means that something is really kosher, it's super kosher, follows all the stringencies and the like. And there is some truth to that, but glot means something very specific as far as meat is concerned. So there's two things to think about when it comes to the ability for meat to be kosher. On the one hand, we have a category called nevela. So something that's nevela would be an animal that died naturally or died without the process of shechita and the proper proper slaughter in that context. So now the concept of nevela, but then there's also the concept of trefa. Trefa is also, I think, a word that in common parlance gets thrown around in a different way than what it classically meant. So the pasuk in Parsha Mishpatim, source one, tells us, and here we'll explain what a trefa is. Pasuk in Parsha Mishpatim tells us, "Ve'anshe kodesh tiyun li, you shall be a holy people to me. Uvaser basadet trefa lo tochelu, and flesh torn trefa in the field you shall not eat. Lakel tashlichun oto, you shall throw it to the dogs." A couple of things before we get to the definition of trefa. A couple of interesting things to note about this pasuk as I'm thinking about it right now. Number one, I think it's worth noting that the concept of dusha comes up very commonly in things related to kashrut. So if you look in Parsha Shmini, where we get the halachot about which types of animals are kosher and the like, so that whole chapter is actually framed around the concept of kedusha. That we sometimes say that that kashrut doesn't really have an obvious reason. So there's certain aspects of hilchot kashrut that maybe can't entirely be defined by reason. But the Torah gives a very specific reason for kashrut, and that's the concept of kedusha, of holiness. And that's expressed in our pasuk also, that trefa animals are not allowed to be consumed because that's a violation of what it means to be holy. So that's one thing that I want to note. The other thing I want to note is that this end of this pasuk that tells us that you should throw the trefa to the dogs. So why does it need to tell us that? We know that there's certain aspects of kashrus where you're not allowed to benefit from kashrus. So, example, dairy and meat. If I cook dairy and meat together, I'm not allowed to benefit from it. That's not true of a trefa. Trefa, I'm allowed to benefit from it because I'm allowed to feed it to a dog. So what is a trefa? A trefa, as the pasuk seems to imply, was an animal that was torn in the field. But more broadly, the way we understand it is that a trefa is an animal that dies or is bound to die as a result of either an injury or some sort of infection or disease or the like. Okay, so the point is that it's not just that if the animal was torn in the field that you're not allowed to have it, but even if the animal, let's say, has some sort of disease and it's not dead yet, but even if I shecht it, I'm still not allowed to have it because that animal is considered a trefa. Of course, the word trefa informs that's a Yiddish word, treif, which we use to refer to food in general that's not kosher. But this is the original context of the concept of trefa. Now, when it comes to the so a question that we could ask is there an obligation to inspect an animal to make sure that it's not a trefa? And for the most part, the answer to that is no, because we have a principle in halacha of rov that I should follow the majority. The local context of this concept of following the majority is related to the judicial system, but implies in a lot of areas of halacha as well. So, you know, for example, if I see nine shops selling kosher meat, and one shop that's selling non-kosher meat, there's a piece of meat that was found on the street, and I don't really know which place it came from, but we can assume that it came from the kosher store because we follow the majority. But there are also that's where you have a sort of quantifiable statistical probability. But there are certain times where it's not like you have all the options in front of you, but you're dealing with some sort of probability. So an example would be here, right? Most animals are not trefas. So it's not like when I say that I'm taking every animal that exists in the world and determining that a majority of them are not trefas, but I'm making an assumption based on probability that the majority of animals are not trefas. So the implication of that is that I do not really need to check animals for most types of trefas, because we assume that for the most part, animals do not have trefas. But there is one exception to that. So if you look at source 3, Rashi says, so it's on this idea of following the majority that we don't check there for the 18 types of trefas. There's 18 possible maladies or injuries that could cause an animal to be a trefa. But there's one exception to that, and that is nukuvas hareya, a perforation of the lung. We do check mishum deshkech bareusa batkina, because it's very common for there to be a deficiency in the lung. And that deficiency is perforation, right? When there's a hole or a puncture in the lung, so that renders into trefa, and that is common enough. So in fact, the Mishnah in Chulin says that this is one of the types of trefas. So that kind of trefa we have to, Rabbi Vadim Bartanur explains that what's going on here, and I'll read this in English just to keep it simple. The lung contains two thin membranes. If one is perforated but not the other, then the lung is considered kosher. It's not a trefa. If both are perforated and the air escapes from the lungs when they are inflated, it is a trefa. But based on the idea of a lung that's been perforated, all the adhesions in the lung are forbidden. So if there's an adhesion in the lung, then that animal is considered a trefa when they are found in places that will be detached. Since there's no adhesion without a perforation, there's an adhesion, then we assume that the lung is punctured. Since the lung inhales all types of liquid, and the liquid becomes thick inside, it emerges little by little through the hole, and it congeals and becomes a membrane. So the way that we know that the lung is punctured is often because there is an adhesion in the lung. So now if we flip back to page 209. So this essay quotes that the lungs draw all kinds of liquids, right? That's found in a Gemara in Brachot. So the essay, your notes, that scientifically that's a little bit strange because lungs generally absorb air, not liquid. The purpose of lungs is not for liquid. And Chazal presumably understood that on a basic level. So there's different ways of dealing with what's going on there. So on page 210, they explain that according to Rashi, although the liquids enter the body through the stomach via the esophagus, the lung draws it out from the walls of the stomach. So this is still a little bit difficult. So we have three explanations for how these adhesions take place. So the Sefer Sichat Chulin explains, this is in the second paragraph, that there are veins and the like connecting the liver and the lungs. Through these veins, liquor or moisture is transferred in an indirect manner. But perhaps one can understand that this moisture has a very important function, as it keeps the external part of the lungs soft and hydrated. As anyone who has felt the lungs know how important this is. If lungs are not kept hydrated, the animal cannot survive, and that would also make it a trade lung. However, sometimes there's too much moisture, and it actually penetrates the lungs. After a perforation is made, this liquid congeals and forms a membrane called a sircha. A sircha is this is what we call this adhesion. So another explanation of this from the Matanei Yom Tov explains that when we inhale, so there's moisture in the air, and that moisture can get trapped in the lungs. So accordingly, the perforation of the lungs occurs from the inside out as these liquids break through the walls of the lungs. These perforations are then closed up by the congealed liquid, thereby forming a sircha. So according to the Tzichat Chulin, the liquid comes in sort of from outside the lung. According to Matanei Yom Tov, the lungs get the moisture from inhalation. And then there's a third explanation by Rabbi Dr. Yisrael Levinger, who explains that that sirchot are actually more common today because calves raised in farms today are weaned from their mother's milk earlier than in nature. This causes a weakening of their immune system and a predisposition to getting an infection of the lungs. So it goes on to say that the main cause of sirchot is due to an infection of the lungs due to contagious pneumonia. So sometimes, you know, the not just the pneumonia that develops within, but the pneumonia that gets passed around from animal to animal causes liquid to enter the lungs. So what we're looking for often in determining whether an animal is a trefa is whether there's a sircha, by the lungs. And the adhesion of and the membranes give an indication that the lung is perforated. Well, elaborate more on that in a second. So Gemara in Chulin says, "Amarava hana tarte una desarchin lahadide late luhubadika." These two lobes of the lung that adhere to one another have no need for an inspection because we assume that it's a trefa, yeah. And that's if the adhesions are out of order, right? That the lobes are adhering to a non-adjacent. One lobe is adhering to a lobe that's not adjacent. If two lobes that are near each other adhere. They're next to each other at here, then that's considered to be a that's considered to be a normal thing. But if they are farther away, that's considered to be a trefa. You can see a diagram of this on page 191 on the right side. So you can see, like, you know, there's in the labeled parts, so there's like a membrane that the arrow is pointing to. So you see these two lobes that are not really next to each other, but there's this membrane that's joining them together. So that would be considered a trefa according to the Gemara. So again, what's the problem with having a sircha? What's the problem with having the adhesion? So according to Rashi, the adhesion indicates that there is a puncture in the lung. So he explains, as this adhesion results on account of perforation, as it is because the lung inhales all types of liquid. Liquid becomes thick inside like pus and emerges little by little through the hole, congeals, and then turns into a membrane. So the way the membrane is forming is because of the liquid that went through the hole in the lungs. So the sircha indicates that there is a puncture in the lung. Whereas Tosfos say that it's not necessarily that. It's not necessarily that there already is a puncture, but the adhesion indicates the possibility. Mishum shesofali hiparek. There's a possibility that there will be a puncture. The chashiv kinakuva kevan shesofali nakev. We're judging it al shem sofo because in the future it could become a puncture. Rashban source 9 raises a question about whether you can sort of test these. So some shoftim came up with the possibility that if you rub the lesions, if you rub the membranes with your fingers, so there's a possibility that in some cases, then the membrane would disappear. And that would indicate, and maybe you could see from there, that there in fact is not necessarily a puncture, right? So the Rashba was asked if that was a permissible thing to do. And the Rashba says, should distance yourself greatly from doing this. It's not a good idea. We rebuke people who do this. And he says, do not be leaning about this at all. You cannot rub the lesion to see if, in fact, it removes, and then we can try to say that it's kosher, right? Because we're judging the puncture in the lung based on the existence of the sircha. So if I rub the sircha and it very quickly goes away, so maybe that's an indication that in fact the lung was not punctured. But the Rashba says that we're not around, once you see the sircha, you're not allowed to try to remove it. We have to assume that the animal is a trepa. So there's two opinions in Shulchan Aruch about this. In source 10, we see on page 192, kol makom she'asru sruchat hareya, any case where they forbade a sircha of a lung, ein hefresh ben she'tehe ha'sircha daka kechuda. So ara ben she'tehe avav chazaka rechuba kegudal. So again, the Rashba was, this is based on the Rashbam, says it makes no difference whether the sircha is very thin and it can be removed and then you can see that there's no puncture. So whether it's a small sircha, a big sircha, we have to assume it's a trefa. If it was pressed down, so after the fact, maybe it would be lenient. But a shochet who purposely does this and then sells that meat is, we consider him like he's feeding trefas to the Jewish people. So rubbing the sircha to see if it's removed and maybe it's not a real puncture. So the Shulchan Aruch says that's not permissible. The Ramah, on the other hand, says, some say that it is permissible to do. And it says, "V'alfa pishi hu kula gdola." So yes, it is a very big leniency, because after all, by doing this, you're greatly increasing the chances of having more kosher animals. So even though this is a great leniency, kfarnago kol b'nei benidot elu ve'inim kol b'yadam, this was common practice in Ashkenazi areas. Ma'achar shishlehem al mashi smoku. They have something, they have what to rely on in order to do that. They go on to say, somebody who is checking these circles has to be a God-fearing person. That you have to press gently, that shouldn't be forcefully detached. Because again, the assumption here is that the removal of the circle is only, you know, when it's a gently rubbed, when you're gently rubbing the circle and it dissolves, but which indicates that it's not a problematic lesion. But if it was a very strong lesion and you forcefully remove it, so in that case, that was probably a trefa. So you need somebody who's very honest and has a lot of religious and ethical integrity in order to make sure that that's not being done.
Is there any difference between number 13 and which says you may be permitted to do that, and the other source that says even though it would it might determine that the animal really doesn't have it, is not a trefa, you can't do it.
Correct. It's two different opinions. So the Rashba and the Shulchan Aruch, like Yosef Karo, the Sardi Posek, say that you're not allowed to do it. But the Ramah does not agree with the Rashba and says that you are allowed to do that.
So the cases are the same.
Cases are the same, but different conclusion. And this is the difference. This is one of the differences between what we call glatt kosher meat. So according to Yosef Karo and Shpan, like, you have to be 100% certain that the meat is glatt, and that there are no absolutely no lesions whatsoever in the meat. Okay? Whereas for Ashkenazim, you don't require fully glatt, fully smooth meat. It's okay if there are small lesions are okay, and so. For Ashkenazim, in theory, it would be permissible to have meat that is not fully glatt. This is what glatt kosher is about. It's about whether whether the lungs have adhesions that might indicate that there is perforation. And Ashkenazim are more lenient about this than starting that theory.
Before we had black coats.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it was permitted to have these small lesions. Is that right?
So the Ramah is saying that for Ashkenazim, that in theory was permitted. I'm going to leave it as in theory. Theory was permitted.
It was different. There was mostly, glatt kosher was an extra, like a luxury. But now most meat is glatt kosher. It's hard to
find. Right. So that's where we're going to go.
Do you have anything to say about?
Sorry?
Does Tony have anything to say
about? He's muted. I don't know what the...
It's an inside joke.
Okay. What's so Rabbi Yosef has a tshuva where he talks about this, and he's very clear. Shelo lechol ela basar chalak or glatt. You have to have completely glatt kosher meat. Levai kashal chasar shalom b'chashas itzer treifa. Leman dat maran hashulchan aruch shekibanu horatav. Horatav. So Rabbi Yosef says that for Sephardim, you have to be very careful that your meat is fully glatt and that there's no lesions, adhesions in the lungs. And he goes on to say, "Ve'adua she'harbem me'od gam me'achinu Ashkenazim yirei Hashem v'chosh v'shmo nishar me'od b'zeh." So he notes that many Ashkenazim are stringent about this as well, and that in fact is supported by Yivilna Gaon the Gra. That he says that he quotes the Rashba saying that that a butcher who rubs the adhesions, so that butcher should be removed. So again, the Ramah says that this is a big leniency, which is permissible to rely on, but there seems to have been a widespread minhag Ashkenaz to not have fully glatt meat, but it was considered a big leniency. So the quote here, the OU, that the Shulchan Aruch describes many types of adhesions in intricate detail. The Ramah concludes a discussion about lung adhesions with a description of a method of peeling and testing many types of adhesions, thereby resulting in many more animals determined to be kosher. Ramah himself expressed certain hesitations about aspects of this leniency, but because it had gained wide acceptance and did have a firm basis, he ruled that it could be followed. However, he cautions that the peeling and testing must be performed by an exceedingly God-fearing individual. Okay, so this we know so far. And they go on to say that for Ashkenazim, there is a tradition that a small, easily removable adhesion is defined as a lower class of adhesion, known as a rear, and that the presence of up to two such small, easily removable adhesions still qualifies the animal as glatt according to Ashkenazi tradition. Eating glatt is a worthy stringency that avoids potential problems raised by the Ramah's controversial leniency. On page 184, they go on to say, it should be emphasized that the Ramah's ruling is certainly legitimate and, in theory, non-glatt meat, if inspected properly, is 100% kosher for Ashkenazim. Today, the OU will only certify meat that is glatt, albeit not necessarily glatt Beit Yosef. So, glatt Beit Yosef, again, Beit Yosef is the Shulchan Aruch, is Rabbi Yosef Karam. So, the Sfarim have a stricter standard of glatt than Ashkenazim. But the OU will only certify meat that that meets high standards of glatt. An important postscript is that the Ramah's ruling is defined as applicable to non-applicable to young tender animals such as a lamb, kid, and calf. Oh, so her, you're right that there is some distinctions. So therefore, all lamb chops, veal, or other meat from young animals must be glatt Beit Yosef, even for Ashkenazim. Right? So certain types of meat, we have to be stricter. But Ashkenazim could, in theory, be a little bit more lenient. This comes up very practically. So again, in the United States, for the most part, you're not going to find meat that is not kosher meat that's not glatt. But in Israel, it is more common to find meat that is not glatt. Well, usually, there are certain machlokot about whether to rely on like regular rabbanut meat, right? If you go to a restaurant and it has a hashkafa from the rabbanut, so if it's not mehadrin, some people say that you should not eat there. And that is, so I've heard different versions of why that is. There are a lot of things. It sounds like there are a number of different things that come up, but one of the major issues is glatt. That regular rabbanut meat, again, is kosher, but it's not necessarily going to be glatt to the highest standards. And therefore, there are many people who do not eat meat from at rabbanut restaurants unless it's on the level of Mahadrin. So the issues that come up also, you know, the extent of the Ashkacha, and how, you know, how well they're checking the knives. Again, nothing treif, but just, you know, but more chumras. The lower level Rabbanut standard is meant to make it easier for restaurants and food suppliers to maintain a kosher standard to make kosher food more available to people.
Is Mahadrin glatt in Israel?
Yes, Mahadrin. If you're eating Mahadrin, then you know that it's glatt.
Oh, that's great. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah. If you say kosher, they not say Mahadrin.
What?
But it might be the restaurant says kosher and not Mahadrin.
Correct.
But in this country, that's not true.
In this country, that's not true, right? In this country, most meat is glatt, regardless. So,
and the base Yosef is better than
well, really,
I was mixed up. I thought Ashkenazim don't eat Beis Yosef meat.
Beis Yosef meat is a very high standard.
So again,
Ashkenazim don't necessarily need to go to that standard, but it is a little bit of a higher standard.
You know, I'm wondering that the whole thing with the Ashkenazim and the Sfardim had to do with money. Were poor in Europe and they didn't want to, these animals.
Yeah, it certainly could be. So let's just go through a couple issues very quickly. So Sefer Kasher and Yaakov Yosef discuss. So let's say you, you're a guest in the home of somebody who does not hold by the highest standards of blood and you do. So can you eat from their dishes? And the answer seems to be yes, right? Just like on Pesach, if you eat in the home of a Sephardi, so even if they cook the rice in the pot, so right. It's not like you're eating chametz on Pesach. So same thing with, you know, if you hold by a glatt standard. So if you eat from somebody's dishes that doesn't keep glatt, so your food is still kosher. It's not a problem. With that said, Rabbi Avagi Yosef and the Yaakov Yosef says that, let's say you have a dish that's meat served with rice. So then you shouldn't have that rice because that rice is cooked mamash with the meat. But to eat from the dishes is not necessarily a problem. A question comes up when it comes to chickens, page 195. Do chickens have to have the standard of glatt as well? Again, the whole issue when it came to requiring glatt for other animals is because we're making an assumption that the possibility of there being perforations or lesions is much higher. For chickens, that's not necessarily the case. There's a tshuva from the Chasam Sofer that says where there is a possibility that there could be concerned, then we should be strict for chickens as well. So they mentioned here that apparently in Israel it happens to be that a lot of chickens seem to have defects in the lungs. But no, they say that there's a number of theories for why that is. Could be because of the dry climate, and they quote some diseases and they bring some diseases and viruses that might make the difference. So this also has implications for the levels of hashkacha, even for chickens. Is that in Israel there's a higher likelihood that the chickens could have trefa problems? The Sefer HaKashrus writes in source 17. And most of the poultry sold frozen in Israel is fattened up. So that's another issue that comes up, or another reason why there might be more problems, and often contains some that are trefoed and have other concerns. Consequently, one should not purchase them except from a known and recognized Mahadrin Hashkacha in order to ensure that all the stages of the slaughter, inspection, koshering, and selling were done properly. Right? So the chicken labels might not say glatt, but there would be some sort of indication that it's Mahadrin that it holds by a higher standard. So this is an overview of the issue of glatt. Again, really just has to do with the concern of preventing ourselves from eating from trefa, of eating an animal with an internal defect, which in most cases, with most of the trefos that are mentioned in the Mishnah, they're not as likely to happen. But when it comes to the lungs, so there's an extra need to check it. And the degree to which it's checked and the manner that it's checked is a disagreement between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. That's where the issue of glatt comes up. The Sephardim are a little bit stricter, but Ashkenazim also, and certainly Minhag in America, you know, we basically by default have accepted this Minhag in America, that our meat is glatt. That's the overview here.
What was the reason for this? Was there a change at some point where before non-glot was accepted as kosher and now it's definitely not? So somewhere in between now and then, something happened, no?
I imagine it's an economic economic factor. And you also nowadays a professional shochtim, it could be that somebody who is got their own stuff. So I don't know. But it seems like it would be an economic.
What happens to this meat? It goes they sell it to a
probably sell it to non Jews, I would imagine, because that's a twist in the pasuk that you're allowed to throw it to dogs, but I assume that you'd also be allowed to sell it to them.
I've heard it said that is an example that McDonald's gets a certain amount of kosher meat. That's not glot.
Could be. I've never heard that before,
and,
but could
and
be.
Therefore, it's possible to go into a McDonald's, get a hamburger, and it'll be non-glot kosher.
Maybe non-glot kosher, but then by the time it's cooked, it's, so you have all the other issues that come. Okay.
So everything is learned from that one pasuk, from the word trei for besada?
Yeah, in this case, yeah. Okay, so we'll discuss things related to liver and fish. It's Hashem next week. Have a good week, everyone.
Thank you.
Shkola.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Have a good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.